This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Our speaker this year is Richard McAdams, who joined us about a year or two ago teaching criminal law, criminal procedure, and several other things. The rate of new faculty hiring is so fast that Richard is practically the median member of the faculty now, as 8 new people have joined us this year. So before he becomes too senior and inframarginal, let me turn you over to him, and I give you Richard McAdams, who will be happy to take questions afterwards.
Thank you, Saul. I'd like to commend Saul for his usual innovative, outside-the-box thinking in inviting me, a criminal law and procedure professor, instead of the usual constitutional law theorist. I've only been at Chicago for a little over 1 year, but my understanding is that we were so deep in the constitutional law rotation that Saul was going to have to ask a former adjunct or senior lecturer in constitutional law to give this talk had I not been available. So if you're particularly happy that I am your speaker today instead of Barack Obama, please let Saul know after the talk. I'd also like to issue a bit of a caveat if I seem a step slow today. On Saturday, I attended my 30th high school reunion in North Carolina, and yesterday visited my nephew at my college alma mater, so I'm still trying to drag my mind back to this century from the last, but I'm happy then to be talking about the future today, and that is the upcoming Supreme Court term that begins just today. And as a criminal procedure person, I'm going to address my remarks to three Fourth Amendment cases that I think could prove transitional in this term. That's three of 4 cases the Supreme Court has taken for this one amendment, which is a rather striking number, I think. The three cases are Herring, Callahan, and Gant. Herring versus United States asks whether the court should expand the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule to apply to mistakes made by the clerical staff of the police. The facts are these. A police officer asks a police warrant clerk whether there is an outstanding arrest warrant for a man named Herring, and the clerk says yes, he's wanted for failure to appear in court. So the police officer arrests him, conducts a search incident to arrest, finds an illegal gun and drugs. Unfortunately, the clerk was mistaken. The court that issued the warrant had recalled it 5 months previously, and there being no warrant nor any probable cause for the arrest, it was plainly illegal, and the normal remedy would be to exclude the evidence obtained as a result of the constitutional violation. But the prosecutor convinced the lower courts to extend the holding of Arizona v. Evans, a good faith exception case, which had refused to apply the exclusionary rule to a set of facts quite similar to these, save in one respect. In Evans, the mistaken clerk was an employee of the court, and the case reserved judgment for whether the good faith exception would be extended to mistakes made by employees of the police, clerical employees of the police. Now, this may sound rather narrow. A clerk is a clerk by any other name, I guess, but it is potentially transitional, and to see why, we have to go back to 1984 when I was a student at Virginia and Saul was a young faculty member there. And the court decided United States v. Leon, the first good faith exception decision. There, the police had searched in reliance on a warrant that was later determined to be invalid. And the court said it would not exclude evidence if the police were relying in good faith on what turned out to be an invalid warrant. Now, at the time, everyone thought Leon was quite significant because I think because everyone believed that if the court opened the door to a good faith exception, it would ultimately apply it to everything the police did. That is, it would say ultimately that whenever the police officer reasonably thought he was acting legally, the evidence would not be excluded. Now, it hasn't turned out that way for the past 24 years. Leon, Evans, and one other case the Supreme Court has decided on good faith grounds involved police reliance on misrepresentations by judges or other judicial personnel. The one other good faith case involved the police reliance on a statute here in Illinois, actually, that was later determined to violate the Fourth Amendment. But the court has never held that mistakes that are entirely internal to the police department are a basis for the good faith exception. And to make a long story short, I think that would be far more significant. That is, as long as the good faith exception applies only when the police rely on other branches of government, it turns out, as I could explain in more detail, to be fairly narrow and inconsequential. So what's interesting about Herring is that it presents the opportunity to extend the exception to mistakes the police make all by themselves, meaning that will not apply the exclusionary rule where a police officer acts in good faith on the negligent error of another member of the police department, or perhaps just on his own negligent error. And by the way, here's a place where the controversy over the use of foreign law in interpreting American constitutional questions cuts in a different direction than normal. Reference to foreign law is frequently seen as a way to push for liberal constitutional interpretations. But on this question, comparable democracies look conservative by comparison, because no other country, to my knowledge, has a rule of automatic evidentiary exclusion. So in other democracies where exclusion exists as a remedy for constitutional violations, it's discretionary and is usually reserved for more flagrant or systematic violations. And this is where the government's argument is headed, the Solicitor General's brief in this case. Don't exclude evidence for any merely negligent violation of the Fourth Amendment, like the clerical mistakes in this case, only for flagrant or systematic ones. Now, of course, one could stop at an intermediate step, recognizing a good faith exception for relying on the negligent errors of police clerical personnel, but not for errors made by police field officers. But I think that would turn out in the long run to be an unworkable distinction, so that Herring may create a new good faith exception that could ultimately create a presumption against the application of the exclusionary rule, a presumption overcome only by showing that the evidence that the violation was flagrant or systematic. So if so, then 24 years after Leon, that case may finally turn out to be fairly important. The second case I want to talk to you about is Pearson versus Callahan. The question here is whether the consent doctrine permits the police to enter a home without a warrant if the resident has already invited in a government agent who signals to the police that he has observed contraband. Now, in this case, police in Utah had a confidential informant go inside Callahan's home to buy methamphetamine. The informant was wearing a wire, and when he saw the methamphetamine, he used a code word that signaled to the police that he had seen the drugs, and the police then entered the home without a warrant, arrested Callahan, and seized the methamphetamine in his possession. Now, Callahan is convicted, but he wins on appeal. The Utah appellate courts accept his contention that the entry of his home without a warrant was unlawful, and applying the exclusionary rule, there really is no case left to bring. Callahan then does something rather unusual, in my experience, for a meth dealer, which is he brings a Section 1983 claim for damages based on the Fourth Amendment violation of his home. The Supreme Court could resolve this case on some qualified immunity grounds, but it has granted cert on the Fourth Amendment question, and that question has been extensively briefed, so I think the case may tell us whether or not the search, the entry into his home was lawful. Now, what I think is interesting about this case is not so much whether we allow warrantless home entry in this precise scenario. There's another, rather, I think what's interesting is how the court would justify the warrantless home entry. One line of thinking would be to apply the exigent circumstances exception, and we could talk about that. But the issue that gets the most focus in the briefs, and that was actually the basis of the decision below, is something else. It is the state's consent argument. And the government says that if you invite an undercover agent into your home, either a police officer or a confidential informant, of course not knowing that's what they are, and the agent discovers probable cause for an arrest or search and then summons the police, you have consented to entry of your home by the police who are summoned. And several lower courts have embraced this reading of the consent doctrine, sometimes termed consent once removed. Now, a first cousin once removed is still a cousin, but consent once removed seems, to me anyway, unrelated to consent. Under the conventional view, the homeowner has, yes, consented to the entry of the undercover police agent. It doesn't matter that you don't know that the person is an undercover police agent. And the question then is whether the consent that you've issued to that person, whether the scope extends to allow that person to invite other people, strangers to the homeowner, into the home. Now, we normally judge the scope of consent by just asking a question sort of like, what meaning is manifested in contract law by what people say? And so here we would normally ask that kind of question in reference to social conventions and norms. And to give an example, if you ask a pizza delivery guy to step inside your house out of the rain while you go get money to pay for the pizza, do you consent to his inviting in strangers into your home while your back is turned? And I think the answer is clearly no, that no minimally socialized person in the delivery guy's position, understanding our social conventions, would think that your invitation had given him that authority. And that result about the scope of consent would presumably not change if, unknown to you, the pizza delivery guy were actually an undercover police officer. Nor would the scope of consent obviously change if the pizza delivery person happens to observe contraband in your home. You do take the risk that if he observes contraband in your home, he can tell the police, the police can use that information to get a warrant and then search your home with a warrant. But we don't typically consent to have brief visitors to our homes invite strangers in, or so it seems to me. It's ultimately an empirical question. So where did this novel notion of consent once removed come from? I'm happy to say that, as with many original ideas, it came from the University of Chicago. When Judge Richard Posner was still fairly new to the bench in 1983, he wrote U.S. v. Janik, the first opinion recognizing what came to be known as this consent once removed. And I think it's fair to say the opinion is bristling with discontent over the state of Fourth Amendment doctrine and is looking for ways to innovate in directions that limit what I think Judge Posner sees as the damage that doctrine is causing. A few years later, he reaffirmed the case and extended it in slightly and explained it this way. Once the confidential informant has seen the contraband, the defendant's privacy interest in his home is fatally compromised. Now, as I said, what is most interesting to me about the case is not whether the police need a warrant in this precise scenario, but the transitional effect of accepting the logic of consent once removed. Remember that consent is not just a warrant exception. It works to void all Fourth Amendment requirements. Most importantly, the police don't need probable cause or any level of suspicion if they have consent. So even though there was probable cause in all the cases that have just been decided on consent once removed, if consent once removed is real consent, then the police should be able to search even without probable cause. So it's not clear why the fact that the person has seen contraband inside your home is critical. If they've seen inside your home, then you could presumably say that you fatally compromised your privacy interest in the parts of the home that they have seen. Nor does it seem to matter if the person I invite into my home is an undercover agent, since I don't know that. So if I invite my neighbor into my home, who actually is not an undercover agent, but just my neighbor, that would also seem to fatally compromise my privacy interest in the parts of the home that my neighbor can see. So it would seem that if inviting people into my home gives them the authority by fatally compromising my privacy interest to consent to police searches of my home, at least the places I allow the guests to go, then every dinner party opens up the house to a warrantless and suspicionless search, at least of those areas where the guests are allowed to go. Now, I don't think for a moment that the court will go that far. I feel fairly confident they will not. But if they accept the consent once removed doctrine, they'll have to draw a line somewhere, and I think that will force them to change some of the doctrine in other areas and make the case a transitional one. The final case I want to tell you about is Arizona v. Gant, which asked the court to reconsider its decision in New York v. Belton, which defined the legitimate scope of a search incident to arrest for someone stopped in an automobile. Now, to back up a bit, it's fairly uncontroversial that the police, upon lawful arrest, can search the body and clothing of the person arrested. And although the purpose of that search is to discover weapons or evidence of a crime, they do not need any suspicion in an individual case for believing that the person has on them a weapon or evidence of the crime. It's just an automatic privilege that goes along with the right, that is incident to a lawful arrest. The trickier issue is how far physically around the arrestee the police may search without suspecting that there is a weapon or evidence of the crime. In Schimmel v. California, the court addressed this question regarding the arrest in a home and gave a standard-like answer, which was you can search as far around the person as more or less that they could lunge or grab a weapon or evidence of the crime. Beyond that, the search requires some other justification besides the search incident. In Belton, the court addressed this question for a car and gave a rule-like answer. Upon a lawful arrest, the police can search anywhere in the passenger area of the car, meaning not the trunk or the engine block, but anywhere in between. Again, beyond that scope, the police would need some other basis for the search. Now, lower courts have understood Belton to be a very much of a bright line rule. And thus, in many cases, the police had arrested someone who was a recent occupant of his car, arrested them while they were in their car, and then handcuffed them behind their back, put them in the squad car, shut the doors, locked them inside, and then gone back and searched the car where the arrest was made. And the defendants have said, wait a minute, at the time that you searched my car, I was fully incapable of reaching any weapon or any evidence inside of it. And the courts have said, basically, too bad. This is a bright line rule, and we don't want to quibble too much about the timing. There certainly was a moment where the police could have searched the passenger area of the car, and so we're not going to worry about that. In 2004, the court went one step further in Thornton versus United States. Here, they allowed the search incident under Belton, even though the arrestee had exited his car before he was arrested. So Thornton was then handcuffed and put in the back of the squad car. So the rule seems to be that the police can search the arrestee's car to prevent the arrestee from reaching weapons or evidence, even though he was arrested outside of his car and even though he is at the time handcuffed in the police squad car. Now, this was all too much for Justice Scalia, who wrote an important concurring opinion in Thornton, which was joined by Justice Ginsburg. And Scalia said that the rule made no sense, and he made two basic points. First, once the arrestee has been removed from an area and secured, there is no reason for a search incident to arrest back at the site of the arrest, to suggest, or at least not for purposes of preventing the arrestee from grabbing evidence or a weapon. And to suggest otherwise, he said, requires imagining the suspect is in possession of the skill of Houdini and the strength of Hercules. But where Scalia is more skeptical of the need to search to prevent the arrestee from grabbing things, he is less skeptical of the need to search as part of a general evidence gathering process. So he proposes returning to a pre-Schimmel line of cases that permits searches incident to arrest, limited only by whether the police have reason to believe that they will find evidence of the crime of arrest, and not limited by the area in which the arrestee could lunge or grab something. So for example, on Scalia's proposed rule, if the police lawfully arrest a person in their home or car on suspicion of drug possession, then as an incident to that arrest, they may search the home or car for drugs. And that would mean the whole car and the whole home, not just some area in which the person might have, hypothetically at the time of arrest, been able to reach. Because there's reason to believe there will be evidence of the crime of arrest, drugs, in the home or car. And that's why he concurs in Thornton instead of dissenting, because he finds that, you know, Thornton was arrested on suspicion of drug possession, and therefore it made sense that the police could search his car. But if the police, the flip side of this is if the police are lawfully arresting someone in circumstances where there's no reason to expect evidence of the crime, then they can't search. So, for example, if you are arrested for speeding or driving without wearing your seatbelt, there is no reason to think that there is evidence of those crimes in your car. Once we've removed you from it, and therefore, under his view, no reason to allow the search of the car. Justice O'Connor would have joined this opinion because she wrote that she agreed with it, except that it had not been briefed. They had not briefed the issue of overruling Belton and possibly Schimmel, and so she joined the majority. There were two dissenters, Souter and Stevens, who expressed disagreement with Belton, but also with Justice Scalia's proposed alternative. But that meant there were only four justices in Thornton that expressed agreement with the current doctrine of search incident to arrest. And now that Rehnquist and O'Connor have been replaced, the issue returns to the court with a full briefing of the issues. Gant's arrest, by the way, was for the crime of driving on a suspended license. Arguably, one would not expect to find evidence of that crime in the car. And he also was handcuffed and in the squad car when the police searched his car and found, seemingly, of course, drugs and a weapon. So on Scalia's rule, the police probably had no grounds for the car search. And if his rule prevails, then the court will overturn a fairly old set of cases, Schimmel being almost 40 years old, which affects millions of arrests per year, and that would make Gant a transitional case. So possibly three transitional Fourth Amendment cases in one term would make this one of the most significant terms in some time for that amendment. And as Saul promised, then I'm now happy to take questions about these cases and possibly other criminal cases coming up in the term, although I don't promise to know about them all. Thank you. Yes?
Well, the obvious question is, what are your predictions?
What are my predictions? Let's see, about the stock market or? I'll go out on a limb and say I don't think that there will be a majority in Herring to embrace the consent once removed doctrine. Now that's a bit of a hedge because it is possible to decide. It is possible to introduce, it might be possible to introduce the other way of thinking about that case, which is the exigent circumstances exception. I think there's some procedural barriers to talking about that, but I think that's the case, though I wouldn't put too much money on that. In Pearson v. Callahan, you know, because this case is a 1983 case and there are qualified immunity issues, you know, it may be that we don't have I think some justices might not reach the Fourth Amendment question. They might just say, you know, even if it is a Fourth Amendment violation, there clearly is authority that the search was valid. There are three Court of Appeals decisions, and I think two state Supreme Court decisions embracing the doctrine. So that would seem to support a qualified immunity argument, and so you might not reach it. If they do reach it, I guess I'm inclined to think that they will reject the consent once removed doctrine. I'm sorry, I misspoke about the first case. The first case is our exclusionary rule case. I don't know. The exclusionary rule case, I think, is perhaps the most important case. As I said, it could reverse the presumption of whether we apply exclusion as the normal remedy or not. There are several cases, a couple of cases in recent years that suggest growing dissatisfaction with the exclusionary rule on the Supreme Court. And so I guess if I had to make a prediction, I would say they will decide to apply the good faith exception in that case. But I don't know. And the third case, this is perhaps going to be the messiest. I mean, we know what Justice Scalia is going to say, and I think we know Justice Ginsburg will join him. And you know, I bet there are at least four votes for Justice Scalia's new rule. I guess if I had to predict, I'll say there will be five. But there'll probably be, I mean, because it's a brand new rule, there's all sorts of open-endedness about, you know, not only how they decide that case, but what they say the new rule actually is. And I think it will undoubtedly lead to more cases down the road. And so I'm supposed to repeat the question. The question was to make predictions, obviously. So other questions? Yes, in the back. Okay, I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Can you shout?
The court that's really valuing the court is not trying to believe a particular cubby hole
or situation that you're seeing in a particular case whether the police were acting in prison. Okay, so the question is whether the court is or should be thinking about this not in terms of fitting a case into a legal cubbyhole, but just asking whether the search was reasonable or not. What I would say is that's certainly what the Fourth Amendment says. It just says it's a right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. That is, of course, what the court thinks it's doing. I mean, doctrinally, it thinks that this doctrine is supposed to answer the question. But there is, in this area of law, as I think in many areas of law, sometimes a dissatisfaction with how arcane and complex the doctrine has become, and how many exceptions to exceptions there are. And so maybe we should just have some more general open-ended inquiry into whether all things considered the search was reasonable. I suppose that's a possible way to do it. I think that appellate courts generally, if they want to control what goes on below at least a little bit, then they tend to want to have something a little more concrete than that, because otherwise it's sort of hard to give any guidance if you just say all things considered. I mean, this is what we did under the Due Process Clause for the voluntariness of interrogations for a long time, was just all things considered, was the confession voluntary or not? And after a few decades, the court thought that it wasn't really, it was deciding cases, but it wasn't really influencing lower courts, because every case had a slightly different set of facts, and without announcing that some facts are crucial, more important than others, it's hard to give any guidance. Yes?
I think the last question was, is it going to be Aristotle or is it going to be Posner? Because rules come from Scalia and Aristotle and Posner says, you look at the facts.
Okay. This was Aristotle or... I'm sorry. Aristotle or Posner. So, the question was also that maybe I would find some greater sympathy for Posner's position. You know, like I said, I mean, maybe this is dodging. I, in many cases, I would reach the conclusion that the police could lawfully enter the home when there was an undercover agent inside who was wearing a wire and who gave the signal that he'd seen contraband. But and so this is perhaps a boring doctrinal answer, but there's a way to get there without thinking about consent once removed. It might not work in every case, but it's the idea would be, imagine it's an undercover police officer. What do undercover police officers normally do when they get to the point where they have overpowering evidence of someone's guilt of a crime? They make an arrest. And so that undercover police officer, upon seeing the contraband, may say, okay, now I'm going to make an arrest. Well, he is by himself inside a house, possibly not armed, depending on whether they thought that was a good idea. And so he wants to call for backup. And it seems to me that that might be a sort of conventional exigent circumstance. You have a police officer lawfully in a home making a lawful arrest who calls for backup. I think, on the other hand, consent once removed, just it's hard to square with our normal thought about what consent is. And you could argue, well, so are some other things in Fourth Amendment doctrine, but I think that it's settled into what I thought was a fairly stable understanding of consent. And there is this hard issue of always that arises of the scope of consent. You know, if you say you can search my car, does that mean that you can disassemble the carburetor? If I say you can search my car, does that mean you can go into my laptop computer and read every file on it? Well, that's a question of what does someone mean when they say yes to the question, can I search your car? And so I just see this case as what does someone mean when they invite a person into their home? And I just don't think that what they normally mean is, and by the way, if I'm not looking, you can invite strangers into my home as well. Sure. A follow-up.
It's not a favor for us to get an answer, but my question was, Aristotle and Posner, and I waited for an answer, and you never gave me one. I think you finally gave me a Posner answer, dressed up in St. Augustine's work. Let me do it another way. This person's family says that in a colleague's amendment, which would be the first, say for the fourth, the court is the judge of the fact and the law. And so the analysis that you were just going through is an analysis not just for the trial court, but for the Supreme Court. The question becomes, which facts do you think they're going to define determinative? Are they going to say the policeman had a reasonable expectation? Do we find that as a matter of fact? And that's a Posner answer.
I don't know how to answer that. I almost majored in philosophy, but I didn't take the ancient philosophy course. I don't think that Posner was... I don't think that the decision that I referred to by Posner was the embodiment of this idea of let's just decide on a case-by-case basis whether the search was reasonable or not. I think it was an effort to work within the doctrinal confines and to be somewhat innovative, and I just don't think it was a successful innovation. Judge Easterbrook.
Shouldn't we be worried about the doctrinal confines? Maybe I want to go back to the question whether anybody will take the Fourth Amendment seriously. The Fourth Amendment says no unreasonable searches and seizures. And then the second clause says, and it's hard to get a warrant because X. What's driving a lot of the cases you're talking about is old debate back in the 40s and 50s and pretty unknown evidence about whether somehow the warrant clause as normal bad is reasonable. But if that gets corrected, if one actually reads the reasonableness clause and the warrant clause as separate things, it's hard to get warrants and demands reasonableness. A lot of the things you're talking about become much simpler. It's reasonable to search a house on probable cause to believe that there's meth inside. The only reason why one worries about consent, poor consent once removed, is because of the holdings back some time ago that somehow warrants are needed to make things reasonable. Relax that and go back to the real Fourth Amendment. You don't have that problem. So what I've understood the original question to be is, what do you see as the chance that the Supreme Court will view reasonableness separate from the warrant requirement? Could many of these doctrinal purposes then automatically go away?
Okay, so the question is, what are the chances that the Supreme Court will completely change its view of the relationship between the two clauses in the Fourth Amendment? So, as Judge Easterbrook says, the first clause basically says you have a right against unreasonable searches and seizures. The second clause says no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause, and has to be state particularly, the time and place of the search, and be issued by or understood to be issued by a judicial officer. And so one, foundational debate about the Fourth Amendment is to say that the only thing the warrant clause was trying to get rid of were the general warrants that existed in colonial America, which were, as they sound, they were not in any sense particular. They just authorized people to go into homes in a certain area. And you could, what happened is the Supreme Court then looks at the first clause and says, we're going to create a presumption that to be reasonable, you have to have a warrant, even though the second clause does not actually say when you have to have a warrant. It just says how hard it will be to get them. I don't see anything in the tea leaves that suggests that the court is going to undo that. It is true that the Supreme Court has introduced so many exceptions to the warrant requirement that it's sort of like hearsay. It may be easier to say the rule is that you don't need a warrant, and the exception is going into a home and perhaps wiretapping, you do need a warrant, even though the court, or at least some justices, continue to repeat the line that there's a strong presumption in favor of warrants. They certainly could do that, and then that would eliminate a lot of these things. It would still get to the question of, unless you said you never need a warrant to go into a home, you're still going to have the question of when is it that probable cause itself is insufficient to go into the home. And unless they're going to say never, it's always sufficient to go into the home, which I don't think they will say. I'm quite confident Scalia would not say, because he has shown that he cares a lot about the Fourth Amendment when applied to home searches, then you'd still have to address this question. And so then you'd have to have something like exigent circumstances or consent doctrine or something to say this is one of the cases where you don't need a warrant to go into a home. You could restart this all, and that would make it easy, at least in the cases where the argument's about a warrant. We could make that easy just by saying we normally don't require them, but I don't think we will. Yes.
Following up on that same question, wouldn't this position Judge Easterbrook is espousing be supported by the Second Amendment decision that delinks the two sections of that amendment?
Okay, so the question's about the Second Amendment in the Heller case. So I'm not sure this is what you meant. I mean, to me, the significance of Heller is it also turns on a home distinction. Is that what you meant?
No, it delinks. The first part of the Second Amendment talks about a state militia.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of the amendment talks about a right to bear arms. And the Supreme Court delinks them, saying the right to bear arms is independent
okay.
of the state militia.
Okay.
What Judge Easterbrook is saying is that reasonable searches are delinked from warrants.
Right. I mean, yes, they could make that argument. They could say that reasonable searches are delinked from warrants. If you're asking me for a prediction here, I'll say I predict they will not do that. And they will not think that anything in Heller sort of compels them to do that. Just because they said one amendment has separate clauses that should be read separately doesn't mean that they'll say that in this case. I was thinking that Heller sort of also emphasizes so much the home, the significance of self-defense in the home, that it supports the idea that there's something very special about the government intrusion on the home, and therefore makes it more likely that they would retain a presumption of the warrant requirement for going into the home. Yes?
You suggested in the consent case that the justices might not reach the Fourth Amendment question. If they didn't, that would seem to undermine Saucy. Do you have a sense whether the justices prefer to make it might be
So the questions about Saucier, which is this case that says for Section 1983 actions, you're supposed to decide first whether there's a constitutional violation before you decide whether there's qualified immunity, and there's an issue in the case about whether or not to re-decide that. I have no prediction about what they'll do about that. I'm not a Section 1983 lawyer, so I understand the issue is may prevent them from getting to what I would like them to decide, which is whether the Fourth Amendment has been violated. But I don't have any prediction about that. Yes. Do I think it matters whether the court in the Fourth Amendment cases focuses on the word reasonable as opposed to unreasonable? I don't. I guess a normal assumption is that they're just, they're mutually exclusive. Reasonable searches and seizures are unreasonable. I mean, if there was a middle case and you said you have to prove it was unreasonable as opposed to just that it was not, did not fall into the reasonable category, it might matter. But I mean, the assumption has always been that it's either one or the other. So it shouldn't matter what you focus on.
Thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.